Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. When you look at murder, suicide, accidental death, and domestic violent rates, my guest today says he's found significant disparities between states here in America that have and don't have what he calls a strong honor culture at its core. Social psychologist Ryan Brown says nearly all human cultures begin with some sort of honor culture where defense of reputation is an all-important attribute at its heart. But in some cultures, that trait fades while remaining very strong in others. In his book, Honor Bound, How a Cultural Ideal Has Shaped the American Psyche, Brown, a University of Oklahoma psychology professor, demonstrates how honor plays a role in nearly all of our behaviors and decision-making in these strong honor culture states. His ranking of states by honor culture showed that the Deep South ranks highest, with states like Texas and Oklahoma also ranking high, 10th and 11th respectively. Then comes the Mountain West. While honor plays a role in homicide and accidental death rates, Brown also offers interesting insights into his research. You know, there are fewer nursing homes in the South and West, as children take in aging parents at a much higher rate than the rest of the country. It's a fascinating look at what fuels our behaviors. Honor Bound is the name of the book. Ryan Brown is my guest. Ryan Brown, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Rich. Thanks for having me.
What initially attracted you to this research that you've done, as well as other people in your field have done, on honor cultures? What attracted you to this idea?
As a social scientist, I, of course, had read the published literature, the studies that other social scientists had done on the dynamics of honor and honor cultures. But I think a big part of what attracted me is the fact that I'm a Southerner. I'm from Alabama. I spent all my childhood in the state of Alabama and the Deep South in the United States, as well as, to a lesser extent, the West, tends to be pretty honor-oriented here in the United States relative to the North. So I think a big part of what attracted me to the study of honor is simply my upbringing and the fact that I resonated so much with a lot of the findings that were in the literature, and it actually gave me a perspective from which to develop new hypotheses and new ideas about how honor affects people.
Now, one of the things you talk about in the book, and you use the example of Scotland, but really honor cultures are a worldwide phenomenon.
Right.
So I'm wondering if you're using Scotland as an example?
Scotland is a great example of honor cultures around the world, but it's a particularly pertinent one for the United States because a big part of why southern and western regions of the U.S. are so honor-oriented is due to the immigration of Scots to the United States in the 16 and 1700s and even into the 1800s. They immigrated to the U.S. in really large numbers and settled in certain parts of the country and tended to avoid other parts. They tended to settle in the Appalachians and from there down into the Deep South and South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, and then push westward. So their influence, their cultural influence, is fairly profound. As you said, though, there are other honor cultures all around the world. Latino culture is a great example, and so the Southwest gets a big influx of honor-related beliefs and values from Latino culture. Middle Eastern culture, cultures all around the Mediterranean tend to be honor-oriented as well. So the Scots really are just one example of a typical honor culture, but they're an example that has a lot of relevance for us here in the U.S.
And so you describe in certain ways how this honor culture developed in Scotland. Can you tell us that story?
Well, sure. And the way that honor cultures develop, whether it's Scotland or any other part of the world, is pretty typical. It's fairly formulaic. So honor cultures tend to develop, we think, in places that are characterized by two main qualities. Number one, what we call economic vulnerability. That goes hand in hand with poverty, just a general lack of resources, but it's especially true in communities where the economy is based upon herding, the herding of cattle, livestock, like sheep and goats, cows, what have you. The reason for this special emphasis on herding is that herding economies tend to be fairly poor, but also they're especially vulnerable to exploitation. So if everything you have is wrapped up in your herd, whether it's sheep or goats or cattle or camels, what you have can be taken from you very easily. So you have to always be on your guard. Herding economies also tend to be very spread out, and so it's very hard if you have a police force or an army to protect people. It's hard to protect very spread out areas. So economic vulnerability is really important, and then the second quality that tends to characterize honor cultures is the absence of the rule of law. This goes back to what I said a moment ago about the difficulty of policing and guarding communities that are very sparsely populated, that are very spread out. But it also tends to relate to poverty in the sense that it's hard to support a strong government with a strong standing army, with a strong police force, when you don't have a lot of extra resources. And agricultural economies tend to be a lot wealthier. They tend to have all the social institutions and supports that help to enhance the rule of law. So all around the world, throughout human history, honor cultures tend to develop in places that are economically vulnerable, that lack the rule of law, and in the absence of a strong state, a strong government, a strong king to protect you and what little you have, people develop a strong emphasis on reputation management and defense. People want to be known, especially men, as those who should not be trifled with, should not be messed with. So in a way, they're protecting themselves in the absence of external protection.
And so to extrapolate, if you're a sheep herder in southern Scotland, you want to have the reputation that if you go and then mess with that guy's sheep, he's going to come at you with everything, and it's not going to be worth the risk of grabbing those few sheep.
Exactly. And the southern Scots were in a particularly precarious situation in that England, from it to the south of them, was always trying to invade and take over Scotland for 700-800 years. This was true. So the southern Scots had the English on their southern border to worry about. They had the Highlanders from the north to worry about. So they were constantly being invaded from the north or from the south. And really, for almost no period throughout their history did they ever have a strong, unified king who was really in control and really had a stable army that had a lot of sort of warring bands and rival warlords and
clans, if you will.
Clans, yeah. The clans were a lot more prevalent in the Highlands than in southern Scotland, where feudalism stuck around for a long time, a lot longer than it did throughout mainland Europe. But so southern Scotland developed this fairly typical honor culture where, as you said, people wanted to be known as those who shouldn't be trifled with so that nobody would mess with them. So it's a way of sort of protecting yourself and your family, perhaps your clan, your extended family network, from exploitation, from threats from outside or from even within the community. And this is the common formula that we see all around the world. And these southern Scots imported this cultural ideology to the United States when they immigrated to the U.S., and they did so primarily via Northern Ireland, where King James, who was himself a Scot, sent or invited a lot of Scots to move in the early 1600s as a way of helping to subdue the Irish. And that didn't really go over all that well, so after about 100 years of trying that out, they immigrated, a lot of them immigrated to the U.S., and so they're known as the Scotch-Irish, typically here, but really they're not Irish at all, they're Scots.
Now, of course, it becomes important to the United States because a lot of those people immigrated, especially to the southern United States. But when I think of, say, the 1600s and 1700s, honor cultures were everywhere. I mean, and maybe in Europe it was a more class denoted that, you know, if you were an upper class, you had the system of honor. Duels were fought over impugned reputations of insults. Is that a little different than the honor culture you're talking about?
No, you're absolutely right. I would actually say that throughout human history, most human civilizations have been honor-oriented. Basically, once you move out of small nomadic bands of humans and these small extended families into villages and tribes that start relating to one another and having this problem of having a reputation to protect and to defend, ever since then, we have been oriented toward defending our reputations and being fairly honor-oriented. And it's only really in the last few hundred years that cultures around the world have, some of them anyway, have moved away from this honor ethic into what we often refer to as a dignity culture. In a dignity culture, people are assumed, just because they're human beings, to have a basic intrinsic sense of worth, of value, of respectability. And they don't have to earn that, because they don't have to earn it. They just get it for being humans. They don't have to be worried all the time about defending it at all costs. And that's what you see in an honor culture, where your dignity, your worth is not assumed. It's something that you have to earn. And if you have to earn it, you can lose it. And if you can lose it, you have to always be vigilant to defend it. But that is a fairly modern invention, if you will, to think about human value and worth in a different way from the way that honor cultures tend to do.
One of the things your book points out is that cultures have adopted the dignity culture or have sort of let some of the aspects of honor culture die out at different rates. One point being a big difference between, say, the northern U.S. and the southern U.S.
Right.
Can you maybe describe some of those differences? The southern U.S. still more of an honor culture than the northern U.S.?
Yes, that's absolutely the case. And one of the ways that shows up, one of the most prominent ways that shows up, is in aggression and violence, in particular in homicide rates or assault rates. So when you start looking at regional differences around the United States, you also have to take into account the fact that there are a lot of different racial and ethnic groups. They're not spread evenly around the U.S. And so when you compare, say, northern states to southern states and something like their homicide rates, what we tend to do in the social sciences is to focus on whites, on Caucasians, European Americans, because it's in that particular demographic group that you see this regional distribution that varies from the north to the south and the west. So among white males, for example, to be very specific, we see elevated rates of argument-related homicides in the south compared to the north, and to a slightly lesser extent in the west as well. That's where a lot of the research in the social sciences on honor culture dynamics in the U.S. started, is looking at homicide, looking at aggression. It's even been shown in the laboratory. You can't let people kill each other in the lab, obviously, but you can demonstrate experimentally that southern white males, for instance, respond much more aggressively when they're insulted than do northern white males. It's important to point out, though, that in these controlled laboratory studies, in the absence of an insult, southern white males are not more aggressive. They're, in fact, more polite than northern white males are. So you have what's often referred to as the paradox of politeness. Honor cultures, in general, tend to be very polite cultures until you threaten their honor. At that point, you got to look out because somebody is about to die, right? So you have these extremes in both ways. And that paradox makes a certain amount of sense if you have a cultural ethic that says if somebody crosses you, if they insult you, if they threaten your honor, you've got to step up and take care of business. You've got to deal with that honor threat. And people generally want to walk around being careful about not threatening other people's honor. So you have very strong politeness norms. You have strong hospitality norms. You say yes, ma'am, and yes, sir, and please, and thank you, and excuse me, and pardon me. And you have these as norms as a way, essentially, to protect against crossing this line, which is really not a bright line. It's a gray area. Some people more sensitive than others. So you want to make sure that you treat other people with a lot of respect, because if you don't, you know what's going to happen. Even when we go outside of urban areas, we see these differences. In fact, we actually see them somewhat more strongly in non-metropolitan areas. It's what we call the small town effect. These differences between the North and the South in the U.S. are magnified when we look at people living in non-metropolitan areas. The reason for that is that in a small town, everybody knows who you are. In my lab, we like to say, everybody knows your name, everybody knows your shame. So if you have a good reputation, everybody knows that. If you have a bad reputation, if you fail to live up to the standards of an honor culture, everybody knows that too. And so the consequences of not living up to the cultural honor standards are much greater for you if you live in a small town, in a non-metropolitan area. So you can make these comparisons in a lot of different ways, and the more specific you get, often the clearer the signal, the cultural signal comes through in comparing people who live in the North and people who live in the South.
My guest today is Ryan Brown. He's a professor of social psychology at the University of Oklahoma and the author of Honor Bound, How a Cultural Ideal Has Shaped the American Psyche. It's published by Oxford University Press. When I think of the most famous duel in American history, it was between two New Yorkers, the first Secretary of Treasury, and Jefferson's vice president. I'm talking about Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr. They fought a duel over their personal honor, which ended badly for Hamilton. So why did this culture die out that apparently was pretty strong in the North at one point in our country? Why is this honor culture lessened in the North so much?
Well, I think, again, when you look at human society throughout human history, you mostly see the dynamics of honor culture beliefs and values. But those beliefs and values, like any aspect of culture, they can change over time. They can be diluted. And the kinds of people who immigrated to the northern U.S. and the north central U.S. were more likely to be English, German, Scandinavian farmers compared to the people who settled in the south and the southwestern United States, who were more likely to be Scotch-Irish immigrants who were herders, keepers of sheep and goats and cattle. And so over time, cultural norms and beliefs do change. They do get diluted with new immigrant groups coming in, new people settling and bringing their own cultural beliefs and values with them. So there were certainly immigrant groups that came into the South that were not strongly honor-oriented. There were a lot of German immigrants, for example, in the Appalachians and North and South Carolina, for example. But there were so many Scotch-Irish that they think of it almost like a dominant gene in a cultural sense, this honor ethic. When enough people are in a community that follow this honor ethic, it tends to take over. It tends to dominate the way that everybody behaves, because you know, imagine having half of your neighbors being strongly honor-oriented and the other half not. That creates a lot of tension. That creates sort of a dangerous situation where the most dangerous people are the honor-oriented people. If you cross them, if you treat them in a way that they feel like threatens their honor, things are going to go badly really quickly. And so people tend to conform to honor norms when there are a lot of honor-oriented people around them. And because in the North there were so many different groups from all around the world that were more likely to settle there, that diversity tends to dilute the power of any one particular group's norms and values. And who's coming in, who's moving to those places in the North versus the South. I think all those things came together and helped. It facilitated the transition of people in the North and northern Midwest in the United States to more of a dignity orientation. That's not to say that there aren't strong subgroups in the North that have this sort of honor ethic. You think about Italians or Sicilians in New York City or New Jersey.
I was thinking of Boston Southies.
Boston Southies, yeah, the same sort of thing. You've got certainly subgroups that demonstrate very strong honor values.
Right.
And they bring them over from Mediterranean cultures or from Scotland or from Ireland or other places around the world that have these strong honor orientations. Russia, for example, strong honor culture. Russian immigrants, Albanian immigrants, they have very strong honor norms and values, and they exist, but they exist in smaller numbers. They're big in Hollywood terms, right? We see them as major figures in movies and TV shows, but they're not really the broader cultural norm in the North in the way that the Scotch-Irish are in the South.
One of the things I really like about the book is you tell, you use both laboratory examples and real stories. For example, you use the stories of the Earp and the Clantons in Tombstone. You use the Hatfield-McCoy feud in Appalachia to sort of illustrate some points. But I really love some of the lab research you were talking about, getting back to the southern-northern differences. There were a couple of studies. One was where a subject is walking down a hall, he's bumped, and the control target responds with an epithet, you know, like out of the way, jerk. But it's
right.
Worse than that.
Right.
And you calculate the differences. And then there was a second part where you had a very large man further down the hall after that occurred, who the person was going to have to move over to the side to let this guy get around. And the differences between southern and northern was very amazing. What were the differences?
Yeah, this is some classic research on honor conducted by social psychologists Dick Nisbet, Dove Cohen, some of their colleagues at the University of Michigan. And they looked at college male students at Michigan who either grew up in the North or grew up in the South. And as I said before, when Southern males don't feel their honor is under threat, they're extremely polite, they're respectful. And that showed up in these studies. They're essentially playing a game of chicken with this large guy who's actually working for the experimenter, but the participants don't know that. He's walking down this very narrow hallway, and at some point you're going to have to get out of his way. And what the researchers did was they actually calculated how close participants got to this guy before they got out of his way, and they all got out of his way. Like, this is basic physics, right? Two objects cannot occupy the same space at the same time, and he's the bigger object, so you're going to get out of his way. Southern males who had not been insulted previously got out of his way much earlier than northern males did. They were quick to turn to the side and basically say, please, after you. Very polite, very respectful. But after they were insulted, these southern male college students went toe-to-toe with this guy. They eventually got out of his way, but they were basically playing a game of chicken with him to reassert their masculinity, which had been threatened previously by another person down the hall who had insulted them. Unjustly. It wasn't their fault, but they were basically mistreated, and their masculinity was threatened by this guy. So now they sort of have to beat their chests a little bit. They have to show, I'm not afraid of this giant linebacker coming down the hall to face me. And this other guy, he doesn't know what's happened before. He's not the one that threatened their masculinity. He had never insulted them. But it's an opportunity now for them to reassert themselves and to show that they're strong. Other studies showed with a similar sort of manipulation that after an insult, southern males gripped somebody's hand harder. They shook their hand harder. Again, they have to show that they're tough and strong. One of the most interesting findings from these studies is that they also show these biological changes. Southern white males' testosterone spikes incredibly after an insult, and so do their cortisol levels. Cortisol is a stress-related hormone, so their testosterone is higher. They're ready for competition and aggression. Their cortisol levels are higher. They're stressed out. And you don't see that same kind of a spike in these biological indicators among the northerners after they were insulted.
There was another study where it was an agitator in a classroom setting, and northern guys got annoyed quicker, and the southern guys were a little more patient, but once they hit the end of the rope, it over-escalated to the point of, like, physical violence. And so it gets to these central points, is that in this honor culture, you're more prone to violence, you take more risk, you're less likely to seek help when needed.
That's right. I actually love this laboratory study. Again, this was Dove Cohen, Joe Vandalo, some of their colleagues at the University of Illinois, where they very carefully scripted this interaction between a Confederate, somebody working for the experimenter kind of secretly, and the real participant, who was either, again, a northern male or a southern male. And they have this very carefully scripted set of obnoxious behaviors that go from really small, mildly obnoxious, to more and more obnoxious. The northerners, they get irritated pretty quickly, and they show their irritation basically as a signal to say, hey, cut it out. Eventually, when the guy doesn't cut it out, he continues to be obnoxious, they give up. They basically kind of metaphorically throw up their hands and say, what are you going to do? And they just sort of brush him off at that point. At about that same point where the northerners are starting to give up, the southerners are finally beginning to show their irritation. Before, it was as if they had covered their eyes and covered their ears and said, la, 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 I can't hear you. I don't notice that you're being obnoxious. I don't notice that you're here annoying me, sort of mildly insulting me, until finally they break and they explode with aggression. And the researchers actually had to stop running the study much earlier than they had planned to, because several participants made physical contact with the other person across the table from them who was annoying them. And again, this person was working for the experimenter and basically said, hey, I'm not doing this anymore. This is a dangerous situation. And this is in a controlled laboratory setting. So imagine how this would occur out in the real world with more people around to watch, right, which is going to magnify these reputational concerns. And maybe with a little alcohol mixed in as well, so that's going to lower your inhibitions. So in the real world, you can see how this sort of a trivial altercation, as the police often refer to it, will turn into a violent altercation where somebody ends up dying. But, as you pointed out, it's not just about violence and aggression against others. It's also about risk-taking as a part of sort of demonstrating that you're brave and you're tough and you don't need to be careful as you make your way throughout the world. We see elevated rates of accident-based deaths in the South compared to the North. And this is, once again, elevated in non-metropolitan areas. And people living in small towns, small communities where everybody knows their reputation, So all these reputational concerns and dynamics are magnified in smaller communities. So people die at higher rates of accidents. They also die at higher rates of suicide. So it's not just violence directed toward others. It's also violence directed toward the self.
Less likely to seek help when it's needed.
That's right. So yeah. So when you do need help, say when you have a mental health need, you feel stigmatized in seeking help for that because that would be a sign of weakness. And you might even be deterred from seeking help by family members who will also feel stigmatized if they have a family member who's getting help from a therapist, maybe on medication for a mental health need. And so it's something we call a courtesy stigma. Your family members might feel stigmatized by your sign of weakness. I want to put that in air quotes. It's not really a sign of weakness, but it's perceived to be that. And so they don't want you to seek help. They say, oh, yeah, we keep that in the family. We don't go out. We don't see doctors for those sorts of things. We take care of it ourselves. You know, toughen up, right? Man up. And so people don't seek help. They're less likely to be on antidepressant medications if they live in the South, even if they're more likely, and some evidence demonstrates they're more likely to feel depressed, which makes a lot of sense if you're under the intense, constant pressure of having to defend your reputation and show that you're strong and tough and brave. And so we see elevated rates of suicide as well, presumably because people are failing to live up to these standards and don't feel like they have any way to get their honor back. Again, if you live in a culture where you have to prove that you're worthy of respect, you don't get that respect, you don't get that value simply from being a human being, and you fail to live up to those standards, so you lose your honor, you may not feel like you can ever get it back, and your only recourse then is to kill yourself.
Hmm. Well, so, Ryan Brown, tell us the takeaway from this book. You growing up as a native Alabaman, I'm a native Oklahoman. For people who grow up in the South, what is the takeaway for this book of how we sort of relate to people, knowing we have this honor culture sort of imprinted on our DNA and on our genes?
Well, you know, I wrote this book really to help elucidate the dynamics of honor cultures. And I think for people living in an honor culture, it's important to realize that you were born into this community that had certain beliefs, certain values, and you are effectively socialized or socially programmed to have those same beliefs and values. So I think it's important to realize what they are, to realize the good that they can bring, right? The politeness, the respect that we show others, the loyalty and even self-sacrifice and bravery that we see in honor cultures, which is a good thing. These are qualities that we probably want to have in our children, in our communities. But you also need to recognize the dark side of all this, the aggression, the violence, the mental health problems, the suicide, the domestic violence that occurs as a consequence of this same belief system, the same set of values and priorities that says you have to maintain and defend your reputation at all costs, whatever it takes. So it's important to look at both the good and the bad that comes from this honor orientation that we see in honor cultures, and to then be able to say, well, what do we really want to have? What do we want to keep? What qualities do we want to display and want to teach to our children so that you can get rid of the bad and keep the good?
The name of the book is Honor Bound. Ryan Brown, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. I appreciate it.
Ryan Brown is a professor of social psychology at the University of Oklahoma and the author of Honor Bound, How a Cultural Ideal Has Shaped the American Psyche. It's published by Oxford University Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.